So, day 28, chapter 19. So, last time we had this notion of bounded function from closed intervals to real. So bounded means the outputs are bounded. And in that context, we defined upper and lower sums. And if the upper and lower sums can be as close as you want, merely by using a very fine partition, then we say that it's integrable. Now remember, I mean, this concept here, you know, upper minus lower sum goes to zero as a partition mesh goes to zero. I mean, you can always take something like that and what does that unpack to? How would a formal version of that start? For every epsilon, there is a delta. It's like the continuity ones. The precise version of this would be, for every epsilon, there is a delta, such that for every partition of the domain, A to B, if that partition has all of its subintervals of width less than delta, then this difference between the upper and lower sums must be less than epsilon. And technically, in the order, shouldn't I put absolute value bars on it? Well, remember, the upper sum is always greater than the lower sum. So this quantity is never negative. So I don't need to put absolute value bars on this. Okay. Now, the way that you turn this into you have these various estimates, but in some sense we haven't said what are the estimates of. So formally now we define the Riemann integral. So if f is integrable, and there's a number that fits in between all of our lower and upper sums, for all the partitions of the domain, then we define the Riemann integral to be this number I. Now, there's two things, of course. When you make a definition like this, there's two things you wonder about. First of all, is there such a number I? Second of all, are there two such numbers, right? You would like to, a good definition has existence and uniqueness. Right? If you're defining a particular thing, you should be able to say it's this and nothing else, okay? So the easier thing to address here is uniqueness, right? How do you know that there aren't two numbers that have the property of that, that have the property of I there? If something is absurd, then you should be able to deduce all sorts of absurd things from it, right? That's how an indirect argument works. So if you want to show that something like that is unique, a common way to do it is say, suppose you have two numbers, right? If they're different, I'll get a contradiction through some argument. If I had two numbers like that, and let's suppose that they're different, so let's say I1 is strictly less than I2. Well, then that leads to a contradiction, because what happens if you try to sandwich I1 and I2 between upper and lower sums that are really close together, closer together than I1 and I2. So, let's say epsilon be just I2 minus I1. Right, that'll be positive. Right. And we'll get a choose deltas in our definition of integrability. Choose a delta so that any partition of mesh less than delta will make the upper and lower sums for the function less than epsilon apart. Now, one minor wrinkle here is you need to know that there's at least one such partition, right? Whatever this positive number delta is, you need a partition of mesh length less than delta. Right? Obviously, you can imagine just making something really thin. A simple choice is just do n equal pieces, right? So, for example, take the number n where you take b minus a, the width of the whole interval, say, which is a positive number, divided by the positive number delta. Okay. And I want to cut this thing up into a bunch of parts. And if this is a whole number, then this would be exactly delta width. Then I could have n pieces of width exactly delta. Round it up, and if it was already a whole number, add 1 to make it something strictly greater than 1. You know what I'm saying? And now this will be a partition.
And the book even has a special notation for it where you use n equal pieces.
This is this notation, right? Where you just do it's pretty soon you start out with A, then you add one nth of the n of the total interval width, the whole big interval, right? You just keep going, right, with equal width pieces. Right. That's called the standard partition, standard nth partition. Right? You just cut the interval up into n equal parts. P5 would look about like that, 5 equal parts. And, okay, now I chose the n to be big enough, right, that it'll have mesh less than delta, and our definition says if your mesh is small enough, or small enough is some number delta that you're promised exists, right, then you get upper and lower less than epsilon apart. And that's the contradiction, because you're going to make the upper and lower sums closer together than these numbers supposedly between them. So, now what do we have? Here, right, this partition, we made it fine enough that upper and lower sums are less than this epsilon apart. And so this upper sum is less than epsilon plus the lower sum. Right? And, well, that in turn is the lower sum is less or equal to this number I1. Okay. But then this is equal to I2 because epsilon is exactly the difference between these two supposed integrals of f, right? But look now, what have I got? I've got I2 less than or equal to something which is strictly less than something, which is less than or equal to I2. Right? You can't have I2 strictly less than itself. That's a very formal version of the argument, you know, in that I didn't, verbally I may have made various appeals to geometry, you know, as well, this thing is wider, this thing is thinner, how I talk about it, but if you actually just read the stuff written down, it's only using the definition, right? So it doesn't depend on your ability to give anything I said a geometric interpretation. So this is a very formal proof. Doesn't rely on any intuitions. It just works directly with the definition. The shorter version of the argument, right, informal, is that you can make these two numbers as close together as you want, right, by choosing the partition P to be really fine. So there's not room for two different numbers in the middle. You can always get closer together than those two numbers. This is a very formal version of the same thing. That's the uniqueness part. Now the existence, how do you know that there is such a number, given the integrability? I've shown that there can't be two numbers that fit in the middle. How do you know there's something that fits in the middle for all? The thing I put here for all partitions P, it's a little bit demanding, right? You have to somehow deal with a partition that you didn't choose. Normally, when you think about Riemann sum, you think about, I'm going to choose the partition that makes the integral be well approximate. But here, this definition, you have to actually deal with all partitions P. So. Well, there's a couple of ways you could do it. The book gives a proof in terms of limits of a certain sequence, for example. I can give a different proof in terms of suprema and infima. However you do it, there's going to be, ultimately, you're going to need the following key tool in order to deal with arbitrary partitions, which is this idea that the partitions have a kind of ordering to them, and that ordering tells you something about the ordering of these sums. And so the concept is what we call refinement. Now, you think of coarse sandpaper or coarsely ground flour versus fine sandpaper, finely ground flour, or coarse pebbles versus fine pebbles, right? Coarser, it's bigger grains of stuff. Finer, it's smaller grains of stuff. The finer is a specific version of saying that you have smaller partitions. So we say P is finer than Q, and write P less than or equal to Q. Right? Remember, this is a partition. So it's encoded as a finite sequence of numbers. When I write this, I'm not saying something like every number in P is less than or equal to every number in Q or something like that. It's a new meaning for this symbol. Right? It's not the old less than or equal to. So the meaning is every interval of P is a sub-integral of some integral of q. Vertically. So every interval of P has to be a subinterval. Right? Example could be like this, right? Every interval of P is a subinterval. You'll notice that these points have to match, right? If this point here that divides two intervals of Q did not correspond to a cut over here, if this point over here was not a cut, then it would be inside some interval of P that didn't lie inside a single interval of Q, right? So whatever is going on here, since every interval of here has to fit inside just one interval of Q, you have to have all the cuts of Q and maybe some others. So another way to say this, right, is just to say that, right, since we encode these things as finite sequences, right, so you could encode this as just saying that P is finer than Q if and only if Q is a subsequence of P, right? We just skip some stuff to go from Q to P. Another idea you need next, since all these lower number sums, remember they're defined in terms of, for each little interval, you take the infimum, the greatest lower bound of function alpha values, to get a term for the lower sum, and you take a least upper bound or a supremum to get a term for the upper sum. And now what you need is, remember, a basic fact about the real thing. Let's say I have two sets, and they're nested, okay? A is a subset of B, okay? And they're both, let's say they're both non-empty and bounded sets of reals. And I'll draw a picture. I claim that if you have this situation, so A is nested inside B, then since A is the smaller set and B is the bigger set, if you look at the bounds for A, like say it's greatest lower bound and least upper bound, those will be tighter bounds, narrower than the bounds for B. More precisely, I would say that the infimum of the bigger set B is less than or equal to the infimum of this inner nested set A, which of course is less than or equal to the supremum of A, the least upper bound. Right? And it's easy to see this if you draw a picture. Here's some set. Here's B, and then A
is a subset of it, right? So it only has some of the points in B. You could imagine these being very complicated sets, but point is, any upper bound of B will also be an upper bound of A, because to bound everything in B, that means you have to bound all the stuff that's in A, because everything in A is already in B. Right? So if you bound B from above, you bound A from above. So the least upper bound of B is also an upper bound of A. So the least upper bound of A could only be lower. Right? And in this particular picture, I've drawn it such that... in this picture, I have supremum of A equals supremum of B. Right. It's possible they're the same. I'm just saying less than or equal, and the infimum of A in this one is greater than the infimum of B, which matches what I have here. Infimum of A greater than or equal to infimum of B, right? Physically speaking, I think of it as I go up the number line until I hit A. That's my infimum, right? Since A is a subset of B, by the time I go up the number line and hit B, I may be hitting A already, or I might have to go a little further until I actually hit A. So I'm coming down, right? Coming down, I come down the number line until I hit B, and then I may be hitting A at the same time, or I may have to go further to hit A. In this picture, I hit A at the same time. But since A is a subset, if I haven't hit B yet, I haven't hit A yet either. The way you write this out as a formal proof is somewhat boring, but I hinted at it, right? You say stuff like, well, the supremum of B is an upper bound of B, therefore it's an upper bound of the subset A. Right? So the least upper bound of A is less than or equal to that particular upper bound of A, which is the supremum of B. But the application here to these integrals, of course, is if you have this situation, if you cut up things more finely, like here, right? Then of course, you consider for each interval, let's call it J, P, there is some interval K of Q with J contained in K, right? And every interval of the finer partition is, by definition, a subinterval of something from the coarser partition. Okay, but if you have that, then you look at your function, okay, your function f, and you feed it every possible input value in J, and you look at the set of output values, right, and you do the same for K. And so you'll get possibly every output from a J input is also an output from a K input, because every J input is a K input. So F, the image of J under F is contained in the image of K, right? This is the set of all outputs from J inputs. And this is a set of all outputs from inputs in K. And this implies a nesting, right? Just like up here. So there's the smaller set J there, so now we have the infimum of the outputs of F of K is less than or equal to the infimum of the outputs where you only feed it inputs from J, which is less than or equal to the supremum of all the outputs from J inputs, which is less than or equal to the supremum of all the outputs from K inputs. We have this nesting.
Very nice.
And this is how we connect
the key mean right here, this nesting idea. Let's say we write P as a book uses this colon. Let's say P has like an N here. Right, I'm not assuming P is the standard N partition. Right? Just any partition P here. Now, when I say N, so it goes from 0 to M. So remember, since P is finer than Q, one way to think about that is that the coarser sequence Q is actually a subsequence of P. So that means there actually exists, so possibly skipping some numbers in here, right? We have a little sequence here of indices that go from 0 to M. will be some subsequence where it's just xi0 less than xi1 xi2. These indices i0, i1, i2 may skip some of the numbers 0 through n, so because q may not have all the cups that p has. Maybe missing some. All right. So we're thinking of, like in this example, you know, it'd be like this is x0, x1, x2, x3, x4, x5, x6, x7. And i0 is 0, i1 is 2, i2 is 6, and i3 is 7. Now, here's what we do. Let's think about, say, the lower sums for p, right? In fact, the definition. Remember, this is, you approximate the, you have this intuition that you're trying to get the area under a curve, and we're approximating from below here. So for each interval of p, remember, we take the width of that interval multiplied by the infimum of the function output values for that interval. Right? The book writes it like, I'm going to write it to kind of match my notation there. I wrote it, slightly different notation last time. And I put like, there's a special symbol for this thing down there. Okay, so you have the greatest lower bound of all the output values when you feed f input values from the first interval, and then you multiply it by the width of the first interval. Okay. And that's the first rectangle fitting beneath the curve. That's its area. Height times width. And then you have to add a bunch of stuff, right? That would be the first one. The last one would be the infimum of f. The infimum of the output values that you get when you feed f all the inputs from the last interval. And then find the highest horizontal line that fits under the graph of f research of this interval. The height of that line is that. And we multiply that over there. And what you do now is when you're looking at these output values, you could imagine, there's some kind of picture here. Maybe so there's P down there, right? Then you have maybe Q, right, is coarser, right? Maybe Q just has one cut right there. Right? So if you were doing the infimum for Q, what's going to happen here? You would have to consider all of these outputs, right? The same graph up here.
you end up this. We actually match that height right there. And then here, and match, end up with this. So what you get is that for each of these subintervals of an interval from Q, you see the infimum, when you have a smaller set, can only be greater than or equal to the infimum for a bigger set of output values. To get a lower bound of a bigger set of output values is harder, right? So there might be more output values. So coming up the number line, you might hit it sooner. So the lower bound can be lower. This height right here corresponds to that right there. And this one corresponds to that right there. Okay, so for each, if you wanted to formalize this, you could say something like, maybe we could write it in sigma notation, for example. So what you do is you break up, the idea is you consider these three, like in this example, I would consider these three rectangles as a group and argue that their area is greater than or equal to the area of this rectangle right here. So one way I could do this in sigma notation would be to kind of express that idea formally. I say, okay, I'm going to sum from, say, I don't know, index k equals 0 to 0 or should be 1? Should start with 1, the n interval. I'll use the shorter notation this time. That's the sum, just this thing written more compactly. Now what I do is I break it up now into a bunch of little sums where I group by which intervals here are inside of which intervals up here. These three are inside the first interval of Q. These two are inside the second interval of Q. So it's going to be kind of an iterated sum. Okay, so now I'm a sum where, say, a letter L goes from 1 to, is it 1 to N? Okay. P has M. Qn. It's like in this picture, n is 2 and n is 5. And so the first group, you know, in this case, I would go 3 of them, right? Some k would go from I, so like here it would go from I, like in this picture, you know, I 0 is 0, I 1 is 3, and I 2 is 5. Right, so I would want to go from I0 to I1 here. In general, and then here I'd want to go from I1 to I2 in terms of which intervals I'm picking out. In general, in stage L, the first one, you go from I0 to I1, right? So that corresponds to IL minus 1 to IL. And what am I summing? I'm summing the infimums of the kth interval. Up here is supposed to be k minus 1 to k. K, summing up all the kth intervals. And now what you do is say, like, for this group of three, round these heights down to the height there that you get from the infimum and with the associated with the coarser partition. Okay, so round down round all these down. In this picture, only those two actually change. So now we're taking the infima over the elf partition from Q. Remember, this picture is just a simple special case with the pattern I'm expressing is general. Now here, so here in this inner sum here, right, associated with, you know, in this picture there would be, you know, n would be 2, right? There's kind of these two groups, right? We add up these rectangles, then round it down, and then we add up those two, these three, then those two. Now, if you look at the widths here of, say, these three intervals, they add up to exactly the width of this interval, right? And the widths of these two intervals add up to exactly the width of that interval. And more formally, when you're summing up xil minus xl, x sub I sub l minus 1. This is just supposed to be k still. Okay, you're summing x sub k minus the previous x sub k minus 1, and you're letting k go all the way from I sub l minus 1 to I l. So if you and you and within each of these inner sums, you've got something here that doesn't depend on k. So this thing you can factor out, and then these, you add them up and cancel, right? And you'll just get, the uncancelled will be a, the last one, the x sub I sub L, and minus the very first one, x sub I sub L minus 1. Write it out purely formally. It's easier to see what's going on geometrically. If you write it out, this is the kind of notation we have to try and capture these geometric ideas. Okay, so I factor out this thing because it doesn't depend on the k there. Then I add up these things, and after canceling, I've got x sub I sub l minus x sub. K to go from the first chunk will be 1, 2, 3, and it'll corresponding to 1 minus 0, 2 minus 1, 3 minus 2. Okay, so actually, okay, so do it right. I have to do a plus 1. So it is possible to formalize this stuff, but it's not trivial. You have to be actually pretty careful to make sure you correctly capture the way you're grouping the areas of these rectangles and adding them all up. And now in the first term, the plus 1 will cancel the minus 1 here. And then finally, yes. And this is exactly the lower sum for Q. It's a real pain to actually prove it formally. But that's why in case you, the formal proof is unconvincing or unenlightening, you know, the picture is worth a thousand words. Round these down, round that one down, and that corresponds to the lower sum for Q. But anyways, that thing over there is exactly, by definition, the lower sum of Q.
So that's the idea here. So. So you have this pattern now that says if P refines Q, then the lower sum for P is greater than or equal to the lower sum for Q. And a totally analogous argument says that if P refines Q, then the upper sum to P is less than or equal to the upper sum for Q. Okay? Okay. This is what a formal proof can take a lot, as you can see. This gives us a kind of nesting here, okay? So now here's an idea. If F is integrable, and let's say now I have a sequence of partitions, okay? This is how we finally prove that I, the Riemann integral, exists. Have a mesh that goes to zero. Then I claim that the difference between the upper and lower sums also goes to zero. Right? And I mean, the quick version of the proof is if n is large, then the mesh of the nth partition is small, and if the mesh of the nth partition is small, then the difference between the upper and lower sums is small. Okay. Now, if you want to make that formal, what you say is, for any epsilon, I claim that for any given an epsilon greater than or equal to zero, you need to show these things are epsilon close for n large. So you say, okay, given an epsilon, I find the delta such that partitions with mesh less than delta make upper and lower epsilon close. Then, since the sequence of meshes goes to zero, I find a wait time, w or whatever, such that beyond that wait time, all the meshes are less than delta. So there's by the hypothesis of integrability and convergence of the sequence to zero, for n large enough, the partitions will be small enough, namely, say, some delta small, where delta was chosen to make these things epsilon close. And you can do that for any epsilon, so that means for n large, these things are epsilon close. That's the definition of limit going to zero. That's
That's the basic idea. You can always unravel it into epsilons, deltas, and wait time. What do we usually write? Capital N for a wait time.
And so now, what you can do is, right, start with this. And then cut it in half. So this one has no cuts, right? It's kind of trivial. And if you want, you can write it in this. And what you do is every time you cut in half again, so that you're keeping all the old cuts, so you're refining, right? So P1 is a refinement of P0, P2 is a refinement of P1. The next one will be... This is how you get... this is how you actually prove that the integral exists. Now what have we got? Well, first of all, the meshes equal 2 to the minus... The nth partition has a mesh of 2 to the minus n, right? And that goes to 0. Upper and lower sums go to 0. Also, since everything is refining the previous partitions, that means that as we go from coarser to finer, the lower sums either stay the same or increase, and the upper sums either stay the same and decrease. So. And remember, every lower sum is less than or equal to its corresponding upper sum. So now you can think of, right, these are underestimates of the integral of f, and these are overestimates. And so you can think of this as like, think of the interval of uncertainties. Like, you know, for this first partition, you have a big uncertainty of what of between lower sum and upper sum, right? But then you have the next one. Now we use 2 intervals instead of 1. Then we use 4 intervals. And the difference between the upper and lower estimates, right, are getting smaller and smaller, okay? So you have, and it clearly, right, we have nested intervals here, right? So you use the nested interval theorem. Thank you. numbers. There's going to be one number I between all of these. Okay, so that shows at least if you do your partitioning via repeated bisection, there will be a number in the middle. But what if there was some other partition, right? Remember, the definition of integrability said that for any partition, I need to have a number I that's between its lower and upper sum. It needs to work for all of them. Same number, right? So now we do one step further. If Q is some partition, maybe. Then what you can do is the following argument. Then I claim that you know, before I do that, I need one. The nested intervals theorem gives me a little bit more, right? Not only is this, I mean, because the widths of these are going to zero, not only is there a number between all of these lower estimates and upper estimates, but it's actually the limit, right? The limit as n goes to infinity of the lower estimates has to equal this number I. But now I still need to show that for any partition Q of AB, I need to show that the number I is between its lower and upper sum. Show that I actually lies between the lower and upper sum for some arbitrary other partition. We've got to work for these specially chosen ones, these bisection ones. Okay. Here's the argument. And okay, so now take any n. Any natural number or zero, okay, or sequence. Okay. And here's what I do. What I do is I want to have a common refinement of Q and Pn. So here's what I do.
What does that mean? It's union, so I'm just, technically, you know, we're talking about sequences, not sets, if you want to get technical. So, to be specific, list all the elements in the sequences Pn and so list all the elements of the sequence Pn and of the sequence Q in increasing order without repetition. Okay. So maybe, for example, here's P2, right? Cut into, it's supposed to be four equal parts. Maybe Q is this. Like it's got that mark in common, but then it's got a different mark here. Right? So I'm defining a common refinement R here. And the way it works is I just use any mark that's on either one. Okay? I just take all the marks from both and put them together. Delete any repeats. Okay. So in this way, I get something that refines both Pn and Q. Remember when you go to a finer partition, your lower sums get higher and your upper sums get lower. So think about this. For example, the lower sum of Pn, okay, will be less than or equal to the lower sum for R, because R is finer than Pn, which is less than or equal to the upper sum for R. Now the upper sum for R is less than or equal to the upper sum for Q, because R is finer than Q also. And as you get finer and finer partitions, the upper sums come down, just like the lower sums come up. Okay, so the upper sum for Q, chaining all this together, is greater than or equal to the lower sum for Pn. Now, the limit of the Pn's lower sums is exactly that number I. Okay? Okay, so by the limit location theorem, you can take a limit and it will preserve a less than or equal to. Okay? You take the limit as n goes to infinity, you've got I. Okay, so that's how you show that for any partition, not just your bisections, this limit that we found here from say bisections is actually also going to be beneath the upper sum for some arbitrary partition. And you do the same argument the other way, right? Mm-hmm. lower sum of Q is less than or equal to the lower sum for the finer partition R, which is less than or equal to the upper sum for the finer for the same partition R, which is less than or equal to the upper sum for the coarser partition Pn, and then taking the limit as n goes to infinity, we'll preserve this less than or equal to. So that L sub F sub Q is less than or equal to I, right? So this is how you prove that from our definition in chapter 18 of integrability, this is how you show that, yes, there really will be this number between the lower and upper sums for any two partitions. Doing this rigorously is admittedly a lot of work. There's other stuff in chapter 19 that I didn't have time to get to. So I will just, you know, mention one thing very briefly because then I gotta go. So, if I have a bunch of partitions with meshes going to zero, and then what you can do is you can squeeze between these partitions. So the point of this is that if you take the limit of Riemann sums with finer and finer partitions, or the mesh goes to zero, you'll get that same number I, because these two go to I. Right? What's a Riemann sum? Well, remember, with a Riemann sum, you instead of taking those infima and suprema of outputs for each subinterval, you just pick a sample point, right? You say, instead of, you know, the greatest upper bound, least upper bound and greatest lower bound, you say, I'll just pick some actual output value, which could be somewhere in the middle, right? And there's more stuff in chapter 19, which I'll have to just leave you to read. Out of time, so happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.